1,000 miles away to the southern Mexican state of Tabasco. The mother was incommunicado for days until she was finally able to call her family, letting them know of her whereabouts. We're not saying the names of the mother or her kids in order to protect the family at the request of their attorney. For more, we're joined first in Tucson by John Washington, reporter for Arizona Luminaria. He covered this in the story headlined, Venezuelan migrant mother and two children deported to Mexico just hours after Tucson traffic stop. He's the author of The Case for Open Borders and The Dispossessed, a story of asylum at the U.S.-Mexican border and beyond. John, welcome back to Democracy Now! Fill out this story for us. Tell us what happened to this woman.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, and congrats on the 29 years. So what happened, this started last week. This mother of four was with two of her children, and she was selling empanadas outside of a gas station in Tucson when she says that she was verbally attacked by someone who was leaving the gas station, and that person then called the police. The responding officers were state troopers, and This woman packed up her things and packed up her children and started driving away. And the officers made a stop down the road. The pretext was that she was driving too slowly, 25 miles an hour in a 40 mile an hour zone. She was taken out of the car. She was extensively questioned. And as that was happening, the Border Patrol were already on their way. The troopers had allegedly called the Border Patrol. She was handcuffed, as you mentioned, by the Border Patrol officers in front of her children. She and her children were then taken away to a short-term detention facility elsewhere in Tucson that was run by Border Patrol. She says from there that she suffered a night of interrogation, that Border Patrol officers were accusing her of being in a Venezuelan gang. They were accusing her husband of being in the gang. They actually were questioning her six-year-old daughter and saying that her dad was a gang member. All of these claims the family vehemently denies. And just hours later, after a really difficult night, and with the nine-year-old son trying to protect his mom and his younger sister from what he saw as aggressive Border Patrol agents, they were deported to Mexico. And from there, they were taken about 2,000 miles south. And not until they arrived to their destination were they able to make the first call. So the mother tells me that she pleaded with first the state troopers, then the Border Patrol agents who were arresting her, and then multiple times during the night to please let her have a phone call, to let her family know where she is, where she and her two children were, to check in with their other two kids and let them know. But she was repeatedly denied calls, both in the U.S. and then also in Mexico.
And John, could you clarify when you say she was deported to Mexico and then transported 2,000 miles? Was this, in other words, she's a Venezuelan. So did the Mexican government willingly participate, and did the Mexican government transport her from the border further down into Mexico?
Yeah, that's right. So Mexico has for some time been accepting Venezuelan and people from a couple other countries deported from the United States. This is a growing trend. The Trump administration has negotiated or strong-armed a number of other countries already to start accepting third-country deportees. And yes, so the Mexican government did willingly receive this woman and her two kids, and then they did transport her south. This is something that we've been seeing increasingly, not just under Trump, but in the past year, where after Biden administration and now Trump has been really trying to convince Mexico to do more to crack down, Mexico doesn't have the funds or maybe the willingness to actually affect a lot of these deportations, these secondary deportations after people are removed from the United States. So what they're doing is that they're busing them south and just making their journey potentially back to the United States much more arduous, much more dangerous, and potentially much more deadly.
We're talking to John Washington, a reporter for Arizona Luminaria. He's in Tucson. We also want to bring into this conversation Grace Martinez Rosas, executive director of United Dream, United We Dream Action, the largest youth-led immigrant network in the United States. She's a DACA recipient, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and her new guest essay for the New York Times is headlined, Why Democrats Fail the Immigration Test every time. She's joining us from New Haven, Connecticut. Greysa, thanks so much for being with us. You know, there is John in Arizona. He has two Democratic senators, Gallegos and Kelly, both voted for the Lake and Riley Act. If you can talk about how that fits into your op-ed piece about why you're blaming the Democrats for what's happening today.
Well, thank you so much for having me this morning. I'll also note that as newly elected Senator Gallego, who won with a lot of Latino support this last November, was the co-sponsor of the bill. So not only did he vote for it, but co-sponsor it. And I think that there's enough blame to go around in this moment. There is a clear strategy that Republicans and the GOP have like advanced that on the backs of immigrants. We know that this is not a strategy of enforcement or only a strategy of enforcement or deportation, but this is a strategy for low wages and legal limbo. We know that immigrants are a necessary part of like the workforce economy, and that when there are stories like the heartbreaking ones that we just heard today, it makes it more likely for low wage workers to not go and ask for the wages that they deserve, not to ask for help when they've been hurt. But this is a democracy. It requires all of us to take action, and most of all, our elected officials, people that are trusted by millions of us to take action and to change the government. And that is where some of the responsibility lies on Democrats. We know that in this moment, we need a true opposition power and party. They have been elected to ensure that there is a pro-immigrant agenda in this country. They have, for the last 40 years, promised action on this. And when the most dark moment in American history for immigrants in recent history happens, what we're hearing from Democrats is we don't have enough power. They're the ones that won. We gotta wait for him to make a mistake. What we know in this moment is that we have to flip the con. We have to flip the script on them. This is not about safety or the remembrance of a past time. This is about the control and like ensuring that billionaires and corporations continue to squeeze out money from everyday working Americans, not only undocumented immigrants, not only immigrants to the U.S., but also native born people. So it is time for all of us to not turn away and keep our attention on what's happening at the White House, what Elon Musk is doing in ravaging our government. And we must have worthy stewards of that agenda and that vision, and Democrats have an opportunity to do that.
And Grace, I wanted to ask you, in your op-ed, you write, quote, many Latinos don't primarily see themselves through the lens of systemic racism, and they see themselves more as other European immigrants. But I'm wondering, there is some agency in the Latino community around these issues and the growing number of them voting for Trump. To what extent does the class character of the migration of to the United States have an impact on how people see the Trump policies? Because increasingly more and more middle class people from Latin America have fled and come to the United States. And to what degree their class origins have an impact on how they vote or how they perceive the issue of immigration?
What we know is that class and power define the conditions of the political landscape. And I guess I want to start off by saying that even if every Latino had voted on the Democratic side this last election, we would still see the outcome of the election having Donald Trump won. So I just want to make sure that like in the narrative, we're not overstating the impact of Latinos voting for Trump in the outcome of the election. And I think it's important for us to note that there have been some significant shifts. And I think that that's both connected to like the experiences that immigrants and Latinos carry from Latin America and what it felt like to have to survive under authoritarian regimes. And people are moving in a way that ensures their the maximum survival. I also think that class and like the transition of class, as we've seen in the cases of Irish Americans, Italian Americans, that there is a pool that both the culture sort of like moves us to wanting to be more absorbed into this country and therefore reject some of our origin spaces. But the truth of the moment right now is that the conditions are being set by our ability to be workers and labor for this country. And so there is a story being sold to not only Latinos, but some Black Americans, white Americans in the U.S. that are working class, that the reason why we don't have enough for our table, why we don't have enough to pay rent, it's because of immigrants. And that's the con that we have to flip. We know that that's not the truth. It's been historic disinvestment in those communities. It's been systemic laws that have kept our people in detention centers and in prisons. It's been the divestment in our education system, the housing crisis that we currently find ourselves in. Those are the reasons. And the greed, the corporate greed, is the reasons why Americans don't have enough on the table and why it's hard to pay rent. And that's why it's important for Democrats, for people like myself, for people in larger civil society to not give in to the simple story that the GOP and MAGA are trying to drive, but to ask more questions and to be clear about what are the current conditions in place. Not only because it helps us understand this moment, but because it impacts real lives. The mother of the story that we just heard right now, that's the nightmare for millions of mothers in this country right now that are holding their kids tight at night. It's the nightmare that my family had to go through when I was 17, when my father was deported over a couple of days. It's the nightmare that like every single American should not look away from, because if once they come for immigrants, we understand and we're seeing that they will come for all of us.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, bring John Washington back into the conversation. We mentioned the Laken and Riley Act, the first act passed by the new Congress. The part of the act also allows state attorneys general to sue the federal government for not enforcing immigration. Could you talk about the significance of that particular provision and what that could portend?
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, and, you know, I think looking at Gallego, who bills himself as a moderate and has co-sponsored this bill, I think it's really important to look at these contours and what the actual bill says. You know, and he says that he has the support of Latinos. When he goes back to Arizona, he has people who support these kinds of measures. But the family that I have been reporting on, the community that they come from, and a lot of the people I've been speaking with in southern Arizona have been aghast at Gallego for sponsoring this bill and for saying that he has the support of their community. So one of the things that that this bill does is it creates mandatory detention, that's no bond detention, for people who are merely accused of crimes. So when someone claims that someone else robbed something from a grocery store or maybe was took something from a gas station, that can result in what we saw with this family. And this is more or less what we did see, because this woman was originally called out by a person who was at the gas station as well, and they called the police on them. That would result in a mandatory detention for them. And as you mentioned, one of the other provisions,
John, we have less than a minute.
Yeah, is giving states much more power to force the federal government's hand to enforce immigration policies, and also they're given permanent standing, so states can sue in a potential future Democratic administration that would maybe try to roll back some of the excesses we're seeing now. States would automatically be able to sue and block the federal government from enacting or rolling back any of these anti-immigrant provisions.
John Washington.
So it's really.
We want to thank you so much for being with us and for joining us from Tucson, a reporter for Arizona Luminaria, and Grace Martinez Rosas, a DACA recipient, executive director of United We Dream Action. We'll link to your essay in The New York Times, Why Democrats Fail the Immigration Test Every Time. Coming up to 20 million people could lose Medicaid. Stay with us.
Rata inmunda, animal rastrero, escoria de la vida, adefesio mal hecho. Infrahumano, espectro del infierno, maldita sabandija, cuánto daño me has hecho. desecho de la vida, te odio y te desprecio. Rata de dos patas, te estoy hablando a ti. Porque
rata de dos patas, two-legged rat, by the iconic Mexican singer and songwriter Paquita La del Barrio. She passed away Monday in her home in Veracruz, Mexico. Her songs are praised as feminist anthems that defy machismo and misogyny and celebrate the resilience of women. Paquita was 77 years old. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In health news, a new study is projecting as many as 20 million people could lose Medicaid coverage under a Republican congressional bill to cut the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion match rate. Republicans are also pushing for work requirements for Medicaid recipients. American Hospital Associations harshly criticized proposals to cut funding for Medicaid, saying Medicaid provides health care to many of our most vulnerable populations, including pregnant women, children, the elderly, disabled, and many of our working class, unquote. We're joined now by Sharon Parent, president of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. She formerly worked at the Department of Health and Human Services and OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. Sharon, if you can start off by talking about the significance of this congressional bill. I think what's missing in all these national discussions is the true effect on people and how many people, what Medicaid, who it's for.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thank you so much for having me this morning. There are 72 million people in the United States that get health coverage through Medicaid. And there are many proposals moving through Congress that would take coverage away from potentially millions of people, leaving them without coverage. And I want to drill down for just a moment on what it means to be without health coverage. When Medicaid is taken away, what does that mean? It means a parent who can't get cancer treatment. It means a young adult just starting out who can't get insulin to control their diabetes, just absolutely essential for them to be able to work and move up the economic ladder. It means older adults and people with disabilities losing the care they get in their homes so that they don't have to move into nursing homes and institutions. It means workers who can't get access to mental health treatment. Medicaid provides life-saving care and access to coverage that is both primary care and acute care. It helps people control chronic diseases, and it helps them thrive. And so when you hear all the numbers and the hundreds of billions of dollars that are being proposed to be cut, the tens of millions of people that could lose coverage, it's important to remember what that means to an individual and to their family.
I wanted to ask you about what the impact, the potential impact on Medicare as well, because Republicans are more and more interested in shifting more retired people into Medicare Advantage rather than the regular Medicare system, which is in essence privatizing much of Medicare.
Yeah, we've seen a real shift over the last several decades in people moving from traditional Medicare to Medicare Advantage. And there are real issues emerging with Medicare Advantage, including that it is more costly for the federal government than traditional Medicare. And unfortunately, people often have health care access issues within Medicare Advantage. But I think what we're going to see this year is a more targeted approach, really targeting cuts in Medicaid, which is our health care coverage system for people with low and moderate incomes. And as you said at the beginning, it is kids, it is adults, it is parents, it is workers, it is seniors, and it is people with disabilities. Medicaid is an important linchpin in our health coverage system, covering, again, 72 million people, including 20 million of whom are now getting coverage because of the Affordable Care Act's Medicaid expansion, very much in the crosshairs for some Republican members of Congress.
And most people don't realize that a lot of the spending cuts are basically as a result of the tax cuts initiated during the first Trump administration that are about to expire. Congress, and of course, most of that went to the wealthiest Americans. Could you talk about that, this expiration of these cuts?
Absolutely. So in 2017, massive tax cuts were enacted. Those tax cuts were very expensive, and they were highly skewed towards wealthy people and profitable corporations. Many of those tax cuts, particularly the tax cuts that relate to individual people and some business tax cuts, are due to expire at the end of this year. And Republicans in Congress are trying to put forward a budget plan that overall would not only extend those tax cuts, but make them larger. And to offset some of the costs, they're pointing to making massive cuts in things like health coverage and food assistance for some of our lowest income households in the country. The cuts they are proposing in Medicaid and food assistance equals the tax cuts that they want to make or extend for the people in the top 1% of income. So there is a direct link between their desire to extend very expensive tax cuts for very wealthy people and the cuts they are putting on the table that will take health coverage and food assistance away from people that struggle to afford the basics. Just to give you a little bit of a sense of how discordant this is, households in the top 1% of the income distribution have incomes of more than $740,000. The tax cut alone for those folks would average $62,000, which is more than the entire income of most people that benefit from Medicaid and from food assistance through the SNAP program. That is how imbalanced this agenda is.
Sharon, last Thursday, former Trump advisor Steve Bannon warned on his podcast War Room that Medicaid is a complicated program to cut. This is what he said.
Get into that discretionary spending. Get into the Pentagon. Get into Medicaid. Medicaid, you got to be careful because a lot of MAGA's on Medicaid. I'm telling you, if you don't think so, you are dead wrong. Medicaid is going to be a complicated one. Just can't take a Medex to it, although I would love to.
So one of the points he made is that many MAGA supporters, many Trump supporters, are on Medicaid. He also called Elon Musk a parasitic illegal immigrant. But the significance of what he said in this last minute, Sharon Parrott, what he's representing within the Republican Party, as I speak to lobbyists who are pushing for Medicaid, talking to Republican Congress members and their staff, these Congress members' staff understand well they're in trouble on this.
Look, Medicaid provides health coverage, life-saving health coverage to 72 million Americans. That is more than one in four people in the United States. People in every state, people in every community, people of all ages, people of all races and ethnicities get health coverage through Medicaid. And so what I think Mr. Bannon was referring to is that millions of people will be adversely affected by cuts that take coverage away from people. Those are the people that are directly impacted, that have coverage, that will lose it and their access to health care. And it is also their family members who, when their family members lose Medicaid, extended family have to try to scrimp and save and bring together resources that they don't have when someone has a life-threatening health condition or a chronic condition. And so the ripple effects of Medicaid are vast. It is an essential part of our health coverage system. And policymakers should not want to take health coverage away from people for whom the cost of health care and food is far more important to them than the performance of the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
Parrott, I want to thank you for being with us, President of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. I'm sure we're going to be calling on you again. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're going to end with federal workers today. Federal government workers and union members are holding protests in cities across the country in what they're calling the Save Our Services Day of Action. For more, we're joined by Eric Blanc, professor of labor studies at Rutgers University, author of the new book, We Are the Union, How Worker-to-Worker Organizing is Revitalizing Labor and Winning Big. He's offering organizing support to today's protests. Eric, thanks so much. It was great to see you last night as you talked about your exhaustion but exhilaration around these protests. You were remembering Jan McAlevey, the great labor strategist, last night at CUNY. But today, talk about what's happening. Is it twice a day in cities all over the country, lunch and after work?
Every major city in the country is going to have a big protest, and the locations and the times differ. What I would recommend for anybody who wants to support federal workers and who understands the importance of protecting our services against mugs, coup and power grab is to go to the website that we've set up where you can see your local event. That's go.workersfiremust.com. So you just go to the website, go.workersfiremust.com, and then you can find your local rally. There's noontime and 5:30 rallies in lots of places, but that's the best place to find the information.
And Eric, what's been the actual number of federal workers already either forced out to take a voluntary retirement or given layoff notices?
I mean, to be honest, everybody's head is spinning. We don't even have those numbers yet. What we do know is that the stakes couldn't be higher, right, for everybody. And it's not just about federal workers. And that's their message that they're coming out with today, is that the attacks on federal workers, they're the canary in the coal mine. If they take out the federal unions, that's our best block right now against Trump's authoritarian power grab. And if you can destroy the power and resistance of federal workers and their organized efforts, then that's going to allow Trump to go after all of the services and decimate all the public sector. You know, who's going to provide Social Security? Who's going to provide Medicare? Who's going to provide basic health and safety regulations for workers? This impacts everybody, and that's the message that workers are getting out there.
Eric, all over the country, I mean, the message being put out from the Oval Office is that workers are fat. You're the unnecessary fat. They're the corrupt ones. They're the ones who are bleeding the budget dry. Can you respond to that as you talk about federal workers as the canary in the coal mine? I mean, we're seeing it's more than 250,000 probationary workers that have been fired. But probation includes people who've been there for decades who get a promotion, and they then go on some kind of probationary period. They, too, get fired.
Yeah, look, the big lie getting put out there right now is that the reason working class Americans are hurting is because of federal employees. And there's just no basis for this. Elon Musk, the richest man on earth, has $412 billion net worth. That's more, that's significantly more than the total pay of every federal worker, 2.3 million federal workers. They get $217 billion per year. Musk makes more than all of them combined, almost double. So the idea that what's at the root of people struggling is federal workers rather than the billionaires that are taking our country into the ground, it's ludicrous. And I think it's time for people to start speaking out.
Well, we want to thank you so much, Eric, for being with us. We'll be out covering those protests in New York City, both at, I think it's what, 12:30 and or 12 and 5:30.
Yeah. So it's going to, in New York City, it'll be noon at Foley Square and then 5:30 at Foley Square. And we're expecting a big turnout. So I hope to see you there.
Eric Blanc, professor of labor studies at Rutgers University, author of We Are the Union. He's organizing along with federal workers around the country. A happy belated birthday to Neil Shabata and to Hugh Grant and Juan once again. Happy 29th anniversary. It is so wonderful to be here with you on this day and with all the listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. We wish we could give you slices of cake around the country and around the world, because Democracy Now! Is everyone's. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thank you so much to our remarkable staff, past and present. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.